That's Miles Davis taking the lead with All Blues. And with five very able-bodied sidemen, including Cannonball Adderley, we just started hearing a bit of him on alto sax, John Coltrane on tenor, Bill Evans piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, February the 19th, and we get even deeper into the case of the IRP6. Just to recap a bit where we have left off. The case is about six executives of a small Colorado City-based software company called Investigative Resource Planning Solutions, IRP, who inexplicably found themselves and their company targeted by federal authorities just when they were about to land multi-million dollar contracts with law enforcement agencies with a case management system they had created. 21 armed FBI agents raided the minority-owned firm on February the 9th, 2005, under a warrant that said IRP Solutions was a sham and was engaging in fraud. They removed several boxes of evidence, including computer equipment and intellectual property. And then on February the 6th, 2007, federal prosecutors sought a grand jury indictment on fraud and conspiracy charges, but the grand jury found no reason to indict. And in a highly unusual move, prosecutors convened a second grand jury on June the 9th, 2009, and obtained a 25-count indictment on each of the six men, charging them with conspiracy and mail and wire fraud. The legal twists and turns in this case become more and more outrageous and bizarre as the IRP6 come to trial. And that is the focus of our program today. We are joined by two guests who were with us in the last session talking us through the process leading up to the trial. And they are with us today, Samuel Thurman and Cliff Stewart. Thank you so much. These two men were affiliated with IRP and, of course, know the intimate details of what has been happening with the company and what happened with the company. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Eutrice. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Now, let's take this. I mean, this is a very complicated trial from my reading of the background of it. But let's start at what set the tone for the trial? What would you say? How did the prosecutors set the tone for this trial?
Well, when you look at it, you see where, as you mentioned in the indictment, this is supposed to be mail fraud and wire fraud, a company that's supposedly a front company. They don't really have a product. They're just fraudulently, going about business with these staffing companies. And that is what supposedly was supposed to be, laid out by the prosecutor. But at the beginning of the trial, in the opening statement of Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, who prosecuted the case, it suddenly took a twist that, anybody who was sitting there found very, very strange, because he makes in his opening statement, this is a trial. None of the defendants, the IRP6, nobody got rich in this. And he goes down this line and then starts to say, well, this is basically a company that got free labor for trying to create their product, which is extremely strange. He changes his strategy, but also when you look at it on the base of what a company does, Eutrice, how a company goes about business, the whole thought of free labor to build a product. Every company that goes into business that is selling a product, they say, if I'm going into debt, it's to build this product, it's to better this product, it's to market this product. So how do you get free labor when you're building out a, you're building out a system, you're showing it to Department of Homeland Security, you're showing it to the New York Police Department, they're asking for customizations, they're asking for changes, IRP is able to do these customizations, to make this these changes, and like you said, on the brink of one contract that's worth $100 million, and how do you say that that's free labor? That is not free labor, that's business as usual. We're creating our product, we're refining it for our potential customers so that we can market it and essentially sell it to make profit, and that profit also to enhance the business as well as pay the debt that the company has incurred.
How is it that this case actually came to trial at all? What did your lawyers do to challenge the grounds of the case prior to trial?
Well, that's the thing. When you look at how the IRP6, how they ended up getting lawyers, they ended up having to take the route of getting court-appointed attorneys because prior to the trial and even prior, prior to the indictment, this same assistant U.S. attorney, Matthew Kirsch, and along with the FBI agent John Smith, who was a special agent in charge of this case, between the two of them, they were going around basically smearing the executives' names in the industry. You know, these are IT consultants with 20-plus years of experience. But everywhere that they went, their name was smeared. They were either told, you know, these companies were told, don't do business with IRP Solutions. DHS told IRP Solutions directly, we have been told by the federal government not to do business with you. The same thing with Philadelphia Police Department. We were told not to do business with you. Even, I mean, everywhere that these men went to try to produce, you know, some type of revenue, their name was being smeared. Gary Walker, who's the CEO of IRP Solutions, he was a director at Kaiser Permanente, a director of IT after, you know, after the raid and just basically trying to go about his life. And the FBI comes to his job, sits down with his HR department, goes through this smear campaign on his name, and causes him to get fired from his job. And that's one example of many that happened to these men during the time prior to the trial. And so they're to the point where they're blackballed in the industry. They can't make money. They can't make ends meet. So they get to the point where their legal counsel is, in essence, a court-appointed attorney who does not have their best interests at heart. Basically, they're trying to get them to take a plea deal, and so they didn't go after trying to find out, you know, what happened in the situation. They didn't go about to really dig into the evidence to see, you know, what actually happened as far as business dealings. What is the prosecutor, the crime that the prosecutor is trying to state, where does that crime actually lie? What happened during the business proceedings that gives this prosecutor the right to say that there was actually a crime that was committed? So none of these things happens from the lawyer's perspective because, as I said, they were just trying to get them like, hey, you guys just take a plea deal so we can be done with this and we can go on to our next case.
Utrice, if I may add to what Cliff was expounding upon.
Is this Cliff?
I'm sorry?
Is this Cliff speaking?
That was Cliff speaking. This is Sam speaking.
Oh, this is Sam. Okay, good.
Yeah, so this is Sam. But to add to what Cliff was just stating, with regard to the attorneys as well, with thousands of pages of discovery, the attorneys, when the IRP6 had their recurring meetings with the attorneys, with each recurring meeting, they found that the attorneys had not done anything with regard to reviewing the discovery. And as Cliff articulated, they had filed motions to the court, basically saying they needed so much budget to do interviews and for travel and so forth. But they didn't do that. So it was as if they were not seeking to resolve the issue, but like Cliff said, they were more so concerned with getting some sort of plea deal. One other thing that is a very, very key point, Utrecht, is the fact that the IRP6 had asked their attorneys to attend a meeting with them to go to the U.S. attorney in Denver, John Walsh. U.S. attorney, and they had basically compiled a proffer. In this proffer, it laid out everything as to how IRP conducted business, what the intent was, and as most of you, and as you know, Utrecht, and as most of your listeners probably know, when you are looking at a prosecution, it goes to motive. You know, was there an intent to do something? This proffer laid out all of the facts as to what IRP did, when they did it, and what was the rationale behind it. They asked their attorneys if they would attend a meeting with them, if they would set up a meeting, and attend a meeting with the U.S. attorney to review this proffer. The U.S. attorney agreed to meet with them only on the condition that the attorneys met with them. Their attorneys refused to go to this meeting with them. In fact, they showed up to one of their regularly scheduled meetings with their attorneys. They walk into the room, and all of their attorneys are sitting on one side of the table, which was very uncharacteristic of the previous meetings. And they had a unified front. The court-appointed attorneys had a unified front that they were not going to meet with the U.S. attorney. And so that was just a blatant defiance in support of their clients that we're not going to go with you to the U.S. attorney to plead your case. And in this proffer, if they had had that meeting and the U.S. attorney had reviewed everything on face value, there would have never been a case.
Why didn't the IRP6 fire their attorneys?
They did. In fact, they did. As a result of this situation with the proffer, as well as just a compilation of events that occurred which pointed directly to the fact that the attorneys did not have the IRP6 best interest at heart, they did fire them. And
was that before the trial?
That was, in fact, before the trial.
Okay.
The IRP6 represented themselves pro se. As Cliff said, there was a smear campaign that was executed whereby the IRP6 didn't have the means by which to hire attorneys in order to do this. The court-appointed attorneys were not doing anything in their best interest, and the judge was not giving them any additional time, really. So a couple of years had gone by. The attorneys have not reviewed discovery, and the judge is basically saying that, okay, you got to go with what you got. And so, you know, basically the guys represented themselves pro se, and from onlookers to include other attorneys who were present in the courtroom, they basically did a stellar job is what other attorneys was their review, is that these guys did their due diligence. The IRP6 did their due diligence. They were prepared. They presented a very strong case. However, as we've talked about in a couple of your previous shows, the judge, Christine Arguello, would not allow expert witnesses to testify. There was certain evidence that was not allowed to be presented and so forth. So the jury was not allowed to hear a lot of the key components of the case. It wasn't that the guys didn't have and that the guys were not prepared. It was just that the judge did not allow it to be presented.
Well, let's take a look at the cast of characters who played major roles in the case. I'm glad that you cleared that up, because I was not sure whether the firing of the attorneys occurred prior to the trial or in the midst of the trial. Okay, so you cleared that up. Now, let's talk about the judge. What was the problem with the judge in this case, the judge Christine Arguello?
Well, Judge Arguello was very biased in the sense that, and I'll put it to you.
Just let us know who's talking so the audience can keep track.
Okay, this is Sam speaking again. We spoke with an attorney friend in New York, and he basically broke down this case. He looked at it,
with a critical eye. And he actually looked at all the components of the case and not find anything wrong with the way IRP was conducting business, as well as the way IRP presented their case. In fact, this attorney stated that a judge will usually give a pro se defendant the benefit of the doubt because of the fact that they are, you know, you don't have the school background, you don't have the knowledge as far as process of law and court procedures and so forth. In this case, it was very blatant, and this is according to the New York attorney, very blatant that Judge Christine Arguello did not give the guys any kind of break, that she held them, and using his words, she held them to a higher standard than most judges hold trained attorneys. And so and the court transcripts that are on record will point to that fact, that she was very biased against the guys and very prosecutorial leaning.
Was it so? Looking back at this case, I mean, just at that particular issue you just raised. Sorry, I have a frog in my throat. Do you think there was a serious miscalculation on the part of the IRP 6 to really go with the pro se defense, knowing that the tide was so much against them that they were really climbing a very rough side of the mountain? They did not have litigation experience, and that in fact this was, they were literally like, shooting fish in a barrel. They were at the mercy of everybody, because a situation like this, a federal trial with huge consequences, if found guilty or if the court prevailed, and to take that on pro se, I mean, was that a good judgment in your thinking?
And Eutrice, this is Cliff, and I'll say, as far as that judgment call, I'll fall back on what the IRP 6 has said. They actually wrote a letter from a federal prison since they've been incarcerated, saying that they feel that going pro se is one of the best decisions that they made during this case. And I'll lay it out to you as to why that is. During a federal case or any case, when you're a defendant, the basis of you being able to not only put on a good defense, but in the event that you are convicted and you need to appeal that case, that appeal is only based off of the things that you object to during the trial. If you do not object to a blatant miscarriage of justice by the judge, by the prosecutor, if you did not object, the appellate court can do nothing for you in that case. They will not even deal with it. So to have these court-appointed attorneys and to already be predisposed to the fact that they want us to take a plea deal, they basically want us to roll over, they want to get this case off of, basically off of their table so that they can move on, to have kept them and then go through the trial and let them nonchalantly let the prosecutor roll them over without making any objection, they would have no right basically to an appeal. They would have nothing to fight for, or fight with, rather. And so the IRP6 made that statement that they feel that going pro se was one of the best things that they ever did during this trial. And just to go back to your previous question about the problem with Christine Arguello as the judge over this case, when we look at her as one of the players in this trial, basically one of the staffing companies, there was a professional or one of the executives of a staffing company, ETI Professionals, that IRP did business with. Her name is Susan Holland. Well, she had connections with the Holland & Hart law firm that is in Denver, Colorado. She had connections with one of the partners there, whose name is Greg Goldberg. Greg Goldberg used to be an assistant U.S. attorney that worked in the Denver office. Well, Greg Goldberg is the one who basically he hand delivered the packet to the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, and basically tells him this is what you go after. Go after mail fraud, go after wire fraud with the IRP 6. Say they did this, say they did that, charge them with this, and basically treats, when you look at mail fraud and wire fraud, those are those type of charges that the prosecutor, they take them, they throw them up against a wall, they make up anything and see what sticks with them. And that's how Matthew Kirsch was able to make such statements like, well, nobody got rich in this situation, but they got free labor, and we're going to call that mail fraud and wire fraud. Well, to go back to the Judge Christine Arguello used to be a partner at this same said law firm, Holland & Hart. She actually worked with Greg Goldberg. And so you look at this conflict of interest, and then we go to what the law says as far as how a judge is to conduct themselves, when they should step down, when they should not. This judge, Christine Arguello, should have recused herself from the trial in its entirety, because the law states that if there is an implication of impropriety or conflict of interest, that a judge should recuse themselves to ensure the public trust. And basically what that is saying is that you don't even want the public to get to form an opinion that the judge may have done something wrong, that the judge may have been out of line. So instead of doing that, the law makes it clear that the judge just step aside, let another judge take it, so that the public trust is kept intact as far as the judicial system is concerned. Well, when this was brought to Christine Arguello's attention, she basically said, you know, she only knew Greg Goldberg in passing, which we found in our research, Just Cause, found that was the furthest thing from the truth, because an article in the Denver Post has Greg Goldberg stating that he knew Judge Arguello very well. And for her to make that statement and say she only knew him in passing, she would not recuse herself from this case. She already was predisposed to information about the case and obviously had a bias when the case came from one of her previous colleagues. So that is just one of the issues on the table with this judge. To add to what Sam said, that she did not give the defendants the benefit of the doubt of not being trained attorneys, but she held them to a higher standard, saying, you know, basically telling them, well, the protocol that you're not following, that is making her upset. The things that they didn't do as pro se litigants, she was getting very angry about it, when she should, in fact, have said, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt because you haven't been trained on court procedure or in the law.
Well, one of the things, having covered many cases, one of the things that became really clear is that the disadvantage of going pro se, and let me make it really clear, I'm not blaming the six, okay? I understand.
Right, right.
That they were in a very strange situation and responding as best they could with the resources, the meager resources that they had. And I also make the notation that this case should have come to the attention of others in the field of law somehow to say this case cannot go forward with these men going up against a system that this enormous system that is set against them. But I come back to the point of, in covering cases, one of the strategies in a case is that the defendant must or should put forward a countervailing theory. But very often in pro se defenses, you have the prosecution basically designing the parameters of discussion and debate. The case is being tried on the prosecution's terms, with the defendant reacting to the charges rather than defying the charges with an entirely different theory of the case. In other words, Was there a time when the IRP6 went into this situation from the beginning, seeing this, telling us what the case is not about, not about this these charges of wire fraud and mail fraud, but the charge is, in fact, what you had said to me in previous discussions, this is a case, the countervailing theory should be, this is a case of the federal government overreaching its power and authority in trying to shut down this firm and trying to kill this firm because this firm had managed to do something that the federal government itself couldn't do, nor could any of its competitors that it apparently had favored, and begin the process of putting on the record, right there, the countervailing theory, the very belief that you had, the IRP6 had about this case, and to just hammer that point home. And so send a signal to the court, which already had indicated a prejudice against the IRP6, that whatever was going to happen, it was going to be said and put on the record what this case really was about.
Absolutely, Yatrice, and this is Cliff again. I mean, you make a great point because, in essence, the IRP6 came in and said, look, this is the government wants you to believe that there is some fraudulent activity going on. In essence, this is a case about debt, a company that had a product that stood above its competitor's product. It's a case about the entrepreneurial dream that says, I will go into debt to ensure that I can bring that product to market, that I can help my country with this product to ensure that what this product offers is a help not only to IRP Solutions as a company, but to the country as a whole to say this is helping to fight attacks such as the 9/11 attack. They laid that out, but what we have to look at and deal with is when you have not only a vindictive prosecutor who, you know, again, went to two grand juries to gain his indictment against IRP Solutions, the two grand juries with the same exact charges, which whenever we tell anybody about that with a law background, they said that is just unheard of, just does not happen. But then you also have a judge in Christine Arguelle who, again, is basically rebuking the defendants for their lack of court etiquette, the fact that they haven't been trained as lawyers, and basically telling them that you should have kept your court-appointed attorneys and things of that nature, when it is their choice to put on a defense that they feel is in their best interest. But then when you have this same judge who would not allow expert witness testimony, who would have testified to the fact that the way that IRP Solutions was doing business was the standard in the industry, who would not allow evidence that showed how viable their product was, and not just, a viability from any layperson's standpoint, but by the forensics analysts that the FBI themselves use to basically vet, analyze, and ensure that technology is what it says it is. So they had Cala Forensics, which is a forensics analysis firm that the government uses, basically said this software is exactly what IRP Solutions said that it is, and it will function for federal, state, and local government. That was laid out. The judge would not allow that testimony. Again, she wouldn't allow the expert witness testimony of Andrew Alvarelli, who would have stated that IRP Solutions was doing proper business. There was nothing fraudulent as the way they were doing business with these staffing companies. He's the owner of a staffing company. He knows how business is run. Also, you have this judge who violated their Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial, and also violated their Fifth Amendment right by forcing one of the defendants to take the stand under the threat of closing their case if they would not have. So although they did put up their defense and say that the government asserts one thing. We're telling you exactly what happened. This is a debt collection case with contracts from one company to another. You have a judge that ensured that they were not allowed to present that evidence that proved that. And in our country, you know, the statement of judicial law is that everyone is innocent until they're proven guilty. And we're finding out that that is a fallacy, that you are guilty unless you definitively prove your innocence. And it's a travesty, and it is a shame before every American that the system states one thing, but the facts and the way that the judicial process and the people who run the system ensure that that statement is flipped.
Utrecht, this is Sam. If I may add to what Cliff was stating as well, the strategy that the IRP6 presented, as Cliff was stating, was a strategy of showing a startup business that was doing nothing unlike any other startup business, and that all of their actions were consistent with what a startup business does. And when it comes to dealing with staffing agencies, all of their actions were consistent with what occurs in that side of the business as well. As Cliff stated, when the expert witness was not allowed to testify, the forensics analyst would have, you know, vouched or confirmed all of these kind of things. But even more so, actions on the part of IRP Solutions post-2005, the prosecution, I believe it was post-2005, correct, Cliff, where they were not allowed to present any evidence as to how the business conducted business with regard to other opportunities, i.e. the city of Philadelphia. And I think we talked about this in one of the previous programs, Utrecht, where the city of Philadelphia was ready to sign on the line until they got contacted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Denver and said, do not do business with them. IRP Solutions was also positioned to do business in Trinidad, as well as Colombia and the Bahamas. These all dried up as well. But it was all the things that Cliff stated to include these items, which I'm adding, were not allowed to be presented, so the jury did not hear this. So the strategy of being a business that's conducting business as any other business, that's one of the things that when the jury only heard bits and pieces and not the entire story, that's where an issue comes up. And then also when you talk about the character of the gentleman, the IRP6. We've talked previously about them being, ethical businessmen. Their record stands up to that. And it will be proven out, even in this case, that they're ethical businessmen, family men, patriotic men. They were very active in their church, Christian men. And those types of characteristics, when bringing that out, the prosecution and the judge even allowed the prosecution to object, stating that their character was not on trial. Well, in fact, their character was on trial. If you're calling me a criminal, then that's an attack on my character. That's an attack on who I am as an individual. The jury has a right to hear that type of thing because it also lends itself to the fact that if it's not in this person's character to do it, then it's not an intention to do anything. And then on top of that, they were already doing business, normal business, consistent with the industry. So it just went south based on the biases of the judge and the prosecutor.
Could you talk a little, I neglected to ask that question ahead of time, but the makeup of the jury, could you describe the jury?
The jury was made up of both African-American as well as white, male as well as female. I believe there were two African-American men on the jury. The jury also was made up of an individual who was an accountant, one who was an iron worker, someone who worked at Dairy Queen. You also had a substitute teacher, and then someone who worked
in the grocery, you know, worked at, as a grocer, grocery checker. So as far as, and that's a key point, Utrecht, and thank you for asking that question, because of the fact that aside from probably the gentleman who was an accountant, it was obvious that the people did not understand, and because they did not have a technology background. So number one, they did not have the understanding of what it takes to start an IT business. They don't understand software development. Most people who may be in the IT industry, if they're not actively involved with staffing company engagements on a regular basis, they're not going to be able to articulate to you how that even works. And so the sophistication, I don't mean that in a negative way, but the sophistication of the jury itself would not lend itself to understanding all the intricacies of this case when it talks about a business startup, staffing industry, doing business with the federal government, and so forth.
And just to add to that, Utrecht, I would say, you know, the notion of the jury of your peers that Sam is talking about, I think is really something that needs to be dealt with, because if you have these people like the makeup in the jury of the IRP 6, none of them had been business owners, none of them, like Sam said, had any experience in the staffing industry or with trying to close a federal contract or with the IT industry as a whole. And so when you have a makeup of a jury like this, in a case that is all about IT profession and all about trying to land a contract with the federal government and all about a small business trying to get out there and do what it takes to make it. I mean, if you have a grocery clerk who says, you know, I'm used to, you know, customer service, being in front of the customer, smiling when someone comes up with their groceries, they're not going to understand pretty much, you know, the stress of behind closed doors coming up with a business plan, trying to lay out what it takes to bring a product to market, laying your name on the line for the debt that you've incurred, and still with the belief that my product is good enough that it's going to make it. It's been shown in the industry and by the biggest customer that I could have that I'm who they're looking for, and so with that, I will incur debt. I will put my name on the line. And to have a jury that does not have that background, and then you have a prosecutor that exploits that and just, you know, doing things like just throwing paperwork after paperwork after paperwork. Here's a timesheet. Here's a contract. Here, you know, doing this time and time again, and the jury's looking there like, you know, a deer caught in the headlights, like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then on top of that, to throw on top of the confusion of the jury and then not allow the defense to really put up a proper defense to lay out any evidence, that is a miscarriage of justice. And as a just cause, you know, we've had a chance to talk to a couple of the jurors, and one of them made a statement that, you know, I was waiting for the defense to bring some evidence. Where was their evidence? Why didn't they present anything? And to understand that outside of the presence of the jury, the judge behind closed doors is saying, no, you can't present this. No, you can't present that. You can't present this expert witness. You can't present an affidavit by a retired federal worker who says that the software is viable and who worked at IRP Solutions and says that this company is not committing any crime. When you don't allow these things in, and then you have a jury who doesn't understand the background of what's going on, it leaves them with all these questions and just to pretty much say, okay, I guess what the government said is what happened. And that it is a miscarriage of justice to say that these people are innocent until they're proven guilty, when you won't even give them an opportunity to prove their innocence.
Well, so far, based on the explanations, and I think that they're very forthright. I mean, you answering the tough questions openly. one gets a feeling that this was not a regular trial. There were so many irregularities leading up to it, and now in the thick of it, we're hearing about more irregularities, about conflicts of interest of the judge, the conflicts of interest that involve the prosecution, the denial of certain rights that anybody who finds him or herself as a defendant, you would expect that they have the right to conduct a fair defense of themselves. And we're hearing very disturbing things about how this trial was going on. What kind of coverage did this trial get in the media? Did you get any media coverage that also raised questions about the conduct of this trial and what was happening in this trial?
Utrecht, there was a media blackout in this case, and you would have to actually go all the way back to February 9th, 2005, the day that IRP Solutions was raided. You have over 20 federal agents. I'm sorry, this is Sam speaking, but you have over 20 federal agents converge upon a business that is in the business district of Colorado Springs. And gentlemen walking around with FBI jackets on and all convening upon one floor of a building, and no media shows up. And then because of the way that the case progressed and seeing that there were, as you stated, many irregularities and many inconsistencies, acts of injustice going on, And there, Just Cause was part of and sponsored several protests. The media didn't cover the protests. As this thing really unfolded, as recent as a year ago, we held a protest in front of the office of Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado, right in front of his office. Around the corner from Senator Bennett's office is Media Row, basically, in Denver, Colorado. None of the media showed up to cover that. And so, you know, it's highly irregular that a case like this, where you have six individuals representing themselves pro se against the federal government, and they're accused of doing something as far as fraud and mail and wire fraud, and the government tries to make it out to be that this is such a big deal. Well, why isn't the media covering it? And the other part of that, Utrecht, is the fact that, and I often use the phrase that if a person is trying to keep undercover the fact that I don't want anyone to know that I'm involved in this, I don't want any coverage at all, but if you're not guilty, you want to get as much exposure as possible. That is exactly what IRP 6 did. That's exactly what Just Cause has done. We have been reaching out across the nation to the mainstream media that there is a serious atrocity, a miscarriage of justice that has occurred. And the IRP 6, and you stated it last week, that the IRP 6 have nothing to hide. Their website, freetheirp6.org, lays it out. And as you just stated a moment ago, we are being very forthwith with our answers as far as answers to your questions. There is nothing to hide. So there is no guilt. Why won't the media cover this?
During the course of the trial, did you get any indication that, how should I put it, special interests were monitoring the progress of this case? Such as your would-be competition or other people who wanted this trial to go the way it was going.
And Utrecht, this is Cliff. As far as, anybody, any special interests, you know, if they were showing up, they weren't showing up in the courtroom. There were a few cases where we did recognize some of the individuals from the staffing companies, but one of the very telling things that happened, and we found this out after the trial, is that U.S. Attorney John Walsh himself actually showed up during the trial, which what we found out again after the fact was very, very rare and strange and not common for the actual state U.S. attorney to show up and sit in during a trial. And so we say, okay, well, if it's has enough interest that the state attorney, John Walsh, would show up, then, as Sam stated, where is the media? And Utrees, when you talk about Colorado and the city of Colorado Springs, where IRP Solutions was based out of, this is not a hotbed of, you know, great news stories. You're talking about things like an otter escaped from the zoo, and that was the top news story for 2 weeks. I kid you not. That was the story. An otter has escaped from the zoo. We have not been able to track him down. 2 weeks, that's headline news. Where's the otter? But you have 21 agents show up at a minority-owned business in the IT business sector of the city, and no media coverage. No one will pick it up. A picket in front of a U.S. senator's office, no one would cover that. John Walsh finds the case interesting enough that he comes and sits in as a U.S. attorney, but no media would cover it. When the media was asked, why won't you guys cover this case where you have six pro se defendants fighting against the federal government? Well, we don't have enough bandwidth to send someone up there. But you have enough bandwidth to chase around a water weasel. That, to me, it makes absolutely no sense. And nobody with, you know, just a common understanding of anything that happens would say that that makes sense, that the media would not cover such a story as this.
Utrees, this is Sam. Also, to add to what Cliff was saying with regard to other interest groups maybe monitoring the case, I have to also go back to the situation of the city of Philadelphia when David Banks and Gary Walker, two of the IRP six, when they visited the city of Philadelphia and had worked their way to the point to where the city of Philadelphia was ready to do business. I stated previously that the city of Philadelphia was contacted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, one of the program managers for IBM, because IBM and Motorola were engaged with the city of Philadelphia at that time, one of the program managers for IBM got his hands on an article that was supposedly had been sealed, and it's part of the smear campaign that Cliff was alluding to earlier, and walked into the IT director's office in the city of Philadelphia and puts down this newspaper article and says, are these the type of people that you want to do business with? And, you know, it's so when you talk about the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that are on the table in situations like this, contracts, opportunities like this, yes, there are people that are going to do anything to sabotage your opportunities to capitalize on that type of business. And since that time, since the guys have been incarcerated, we also have noted that there are several government agencies that have been hitting the IRP6 website. So, you know, we get a weekly status report on, you know, how many page loads and how many, you know, impressions and that type of thing. And so there are agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, Department of the Navy, there are agencies that are hitting that page. Why? Obviously, IRP had something to offer. IRP has something to offer. And so even with the gentleman having been incarcerated wrongly for 18 months, people are still following.
Well, yes, we should say that the trial went on for 3 weeks and resulted in convictions. In our next chapter, we'll talk about what happened after the trial and ways in which the IRP6 have been trying to expunge those convictions and to defend themselves again against those convictions. That will be our next chapter. But I want to thank you for coursing us through this piece of it, the trial, and again, the constant theme being irregularities and inexplicable things that are being done in the open, and yet the escape coverage and the escape monitoring all the way around. In the industry, the legal industry should have had some kind of interest here. The African American legal associations and basic lawyers associations should have had an interest in this case. And yet we find that the IRP6 are going it alone. I mean, it's a very, very courageous thing to do, to take your chances with a case of this magnitude, to take, you know, your fate into your own hands. So we'll talk about what happened after the trial, the efforts of the IRP6 to obtain records and so forth to continue with their appeals, and we will do that in the next session. I want to let the audience know that so far we've been getting comprehensive reports from inside of the IRP6, if you will, about what really happened. We haven't had a chance to ask questions. The listeners haven't had a chance to ask questions. And really, I wanted it that way only because I wanted first to have the information shared as thoroughly as we can do it without interruption, which is the way we do our presentations, if you know. We allow our presenters to speak uninterrupted, and then we open up for questions. So there will come a time, and we'll spend a great deal of time just on questions, and we will have our guests available to answer them. And I wanted first, though, to present this in a kind of orderly way so we can appreciate the case as it goes. And then we will have, at the end of the information sharing, we will have a session devoted entirely to questions and to your comments and observations about the IRP6. But before we go, let's discuss what's happening with A Just Cause and how people can get information. What is the organization doing now?
Utrecht, Just Cause is continuing its support of the IRP6. We have a petition out on change.org. Go to change.org and sign the petition regarding the 200 pages of missing transcript, and Cliff talked about the Fifth Amendment violation. These 200 pages hold the key to that Fifth Amendment violation. And so that is currently part of the point on appeal. We are also seeking donations. You can go to www.a-justcause.com. Again, a-justcause.com, and click the donate button. Right now we are working on a 501c3 designation. But in the meantime, if you believe in this type of cause, and it's more than about the IRP6, there are hundreds of people in this country who are wrongly incarcerated and wrongly convicted. And so A Just Cause is fighting on that behalf. And Utrecht, I know you're trying to wrap up. Let me just throw in one other point. You mentioned about African-American or minority folks coming to bat for the IRP6. The IRP6 did, in fact, meet with the Black Bar of Denver. And at the end of the day, to keep it short, the one of the representatives from the Black Bar, I believe it was the president of the Black Bar, he basically told the IRP6 that I need to get paid. And in order for me to even consider something like this, or for me to bring anybody in on this, I need to get paid. And so that is absurd. I mean, when you look, this is Black History Month. And when you look at the struggles of the civil rights movement, and there are a lot of things on television, what happened to the day when attorneys stepped up to the plate, when they saw an injustice, stepped up to the plate and said, we need to right this wrong? When that happened, that left a very, very bad taste in the mouth of IRP6 and everyone else associated with them, to include me, that someone would say something like that.
Wow. Well, that's the reality. But I do know that you have managed, the IRP6 has managed to attract a rather significant helper, and we'll get to that eventually as we go about discussing the appeals process. So thank you so very much. I really want to let you know how greatly I appreciate the fact that you taking the time explaining the situation as it is. Your answers to the questions have been quite forthright, and it is a case that requires, I think, some attention, and I hope people become involved in monitoring this case, because it has implications way beyond the IRP6. Thanks so much, yes. Samuel Thurman and Cliff Stewart, for being with us today.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you, Yatrice.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program. Again, I just want to stress that we are learning the facts of this case as we go. And in order to appreciate the enormity of the situation, and also, of course, to shape our questions when the time comes. But we will be spending a lot of time with your questions, so that's why I'm hoping that taking the case bit by bit is going to help. Well, thank you so much. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. You want to keep it right here for that. And you can drop me a line. Make sure you do, at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Yatrice Lead. Bye-bye. Thank you.